Welcome to Heart to Heart with Keisha B., the podcast that focuses on the journey of grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. Whether you're dealing with loss or life challenges, this is a podcast that you don't want to miss. I am your host, Keisha B. So take a deep breath, open your mind and your soul, and sit back as we embark on this journey together. Are you seeking support from someone who can help you rediscover your purpose, reconnect with your heart, and rebuild your life while honoring the legacy of your child that you love so deeply? Hello, I'm Lakeisha Baron Brown, therapist, grief coach, and host of Heart to Heart with Keisha B. I am a mother who understands your pain, and I have the heart to guide you as you move forward through your grief and healing journey. Welcome to Heart with Keisha B. This is a space that focuses on grief, healing, and overcoming unforeseen circumstances. If you are a new listener, welcome. If you are a returning listener, thank you for your continuous support. And if you're ready to engage in raw, uncomfortable conversations, you are in the right place. So listeners, as you know, every week on Heart to Heart with Keisha B, we always bring a guest to you that not only shares their story, but their story is uplifting, empowering, and will change your life. And as you know, I always say, if you are trying to have change in your life, we must focus on some uncomfortable conversations. And again, I know that everything may not always be what you like, but in order to have change, we must discuss uncomfortable conversations. Today's topic is caregiving with love, Mark's story. And so at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mark to have him share with you all why this story is not only so impactful for him, but how it also enlightens, inspire, and uplift other people. Mark, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you to tell us a little bit about who is Mark and why is this story so impactful to your life?
Okay, well, I was 55 and living the carefree bachelor life in Los Angeles. And I decided to give all that up to become a first-time parent to a sharp-tongued, guilt-tripping, stubborn-as-all-get-out lady who could barely remember my name. And that was my mom. Okay. But I jumped in with gusto and took over the 24/7 caregiving because I thought my mother deserved better. And so I wanted to fill her last years with love, laughter, and joy. And it wasn't always successful, but we came pretty damn close.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you say that she deserves better. I understand that as a child, but sort of share with us what made you say that she deserved better. And like you said, you became a parent to a 90-year-old woman.
Well, my mother had what we called a near-death experience right after her 89th birthday. So we all rushed home. The doctor cut off all meds and food and drink and said she's transitioning. They called hospice. And so we were on death watch. So she had all of her six children came home. And she was not happy. She was living in the house we all grew up in. And we had a family living upstairs that were supposed to oversee household duties and keep mom company. And mom had some bouts with depression throughout her life, but she hid it very well. But this time she let it go. And I think she looked around and said, boy, if this is my life, if this is what it's going to be the rest of the years, I'm done. Right. So she kind of willed herself to die. There was no medical or physical reason why. It was all, I guess, a mental choice. Mm-hmm. But she was like in a semi-comatose state when I got home, and hospice was there caring for her. And so my younger sister and I hung out with hospice because we wanted to take care of our mother as much as we were allowed to for as long as she wanted to be here. We didn't know if she was going soon or is going to hang out for a while or not. So we learned the tips and tricks from hospice. They were very generous. We hung out with mom. Someone always stayed in the room with her. I have a chapter in the book called The Silent Scream, and I think it was a cry for help. She wanted love back into her home and certainly back into her life. And with all her kids there, I think she felt that. She barely opened her eyes. She never spoke, but she did seem to respond to touch. Mm-hmm. And I think she knew we were there. And the longer we stayed, I think she decided to give life a second shot. And a few weeks later, with the little help of a, we had a number of hospice nurses coming in. So we had quite a revolving door of hospice nurses. And we found out that most of them didn't obey their bosses. They'd like to prescribe their own medicine. So this one particular one, the directive again was no food, no drink, no medication.
Right.
She's transitioning. Let her go. Keep her as comfortable as possible, but none of those things. Mm-hmm. So this nurse read that, and then she went right into my mother's room and said, Mrs. Poro, are you hungry? And my mother's eyes opened up for the first time in weeks. And we're like, what is going on here? And then this nurse accused us of trying to starve our mother to death. So took exception to that. And so we told her to go call her supervisor because she broke the rules. And the supervisor said, you need to leave because you broke the rules. These people are not trying to starve their mother to death.
Right.
But now I'm thinking that might be a possibility that the assessment was wrong and mom was not ready to go. So now I'm racked with guilt and I go into her room and I lean in and I say, Mom, are you hungry? And she looks at me and she says, well, what do you got? And again, these are the first words, probably three, four weeks.
Wow.
And I said, well, anything you want. And she says, well, how about some pumpkin pie? And it's March. It's not exactly pumpkin pie season.
Right.
My brother lived locally and he was in the living room. So I went out and asked him if he wanted to take on the challenge. He came back within 30 minutes with two fresh pumpkin pies. Wow. I have no idea where he found them, if he baked them himself, or I don't know. But we went into mom's room, and I gave her a spoonful. And the first spoonful she spit out, because, it was the first food in weeks. So I said, well, that didn't go so well, but let's try again. And the second spoonful was successful, and then she ended up downing half the pie.
Wow.
And her color returned. She was wide awake and alert, and we said, oh my gosh, this is working. So the next day she finished off the second half of that pie, and the next day I think she polished off the entire pie in one sitting. And she was back. It was great. So we don't know if she was riding the most continuous sugar high or not, but it worked, and she was 89. So we said, anything you want. And it was lovely. And I hadn't been there. I hadn't been back there for several months because mom with her depression could be kind of a grumpy, unpleasant person to be around. And so I was absent for a number of months. And so she woke up. When she woke up and was alert, she hit me with the guilt tripping. She looked at me and she said, well, I haven't seen you in a long while. So then I knew with the guilt tripping, my mother was in fact back.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, I'm right now, I'm sort of lost for words, you know, because it's one of those things that they say, you just never know. Right. And what I hear you saying is that in a moment that everyone else was ready to say, this is it, she was given a second part of life that, you know, here's her witty self again, you know, and like you say, everybody's just shocked and surprised, like what's going on. So just with me right now, I'm sort of lost for words because I couldn't imagine what I would have been like mentally in that moment when you were preparing yourself for something that you wasn't ready for, but then boom, here comes your mom. So with that leads me to ask you, what was the biggest challenges during that time, emotionally, mentally, physically, and even spiritually, with not just that moment, but just caring for your mother thereafter?
Well, I didn't jump in, into the full-time care yet. Again, we hung out with hospice. And so, the first, I guess, shock would be I'm seeing my mother naked for the first time.
Yeah.
And for a son, it's like, oh, that's something I got to deal with. But I chose to take on this, I guess, at this point, not the full-time job, but to do this. I wanted to care for my mom. So I had to get over it and on with it because I had a new job to do. Mm-hmm. Or I say, you know, with my acting experience, I had a new role and I was going to play it to its full extent. So we learned how to do the sponge bathing and to change the diapers and change the bedding with a helpless patient in bed and deal with, she had some bed sores at that time. So we had to deal with the medical issues and all that stuff. Again, you have to, I think, put aside that this is your mom and you love her dearly. But there's things we have to tend to. We have to, because now not at that point, but at one point later on, you know, her life was literally in my hands. Mm-hmm. So I had to, not be the son who's embarrassed or anything like that. It was, I have a job to do, and I'm going to do the best I can to make sure my mother's as comfortable and healthy and safe as possible.
Right. So walk us through some of those days, because I've heard you already give some characteristics of who your mother was. So walk us through some of those days. I want to say some of the good days, some of the bad days, some of the days that you was just ready to cry, and many of the days that you were laughing as well.
Mom just started eating, let's say, after 3 weeks of not doing anything. So she's eating, and she was, I had to change her diapers often, but she hadn't pooped yet. But she was peeing like a crazy, like a newborn. Mm-hmm. There's some dangers that come with that. If you are not, exiting these things out of your body, they can become toxic and they could cause problems. So hospice, luckily, was on duty with me at that point. So we had to figure out how to get this stuff out of there. And luckily, Sir Isaac Newton came to the rescue because gravity seemed to do it, because she was bedridden at this point. And we had a commode. My family has a tradition of never throwing anything away. Mm-hmm. So we figured, 14 years earlier, my dad passed, and we had a commode for him. And I figured, boy, it's got to be in this house somewhere. So I went and searched, and I found this commode. And then once we got her on the commode, everything just came out. And it was lovely, and I tried to make fun of it. And the chapter is actually quite funny, but I don't want to ruin that for people. But I called it the miracle poop. Because mm-hmm. after that, she had no problem with normal bowel movements and stuff like that. So, again, those are things that you think a son's never going to have to deal with his mother. But, I took on this role. So it was like there's no line that I was not willing to cross, as uncomfortable as it could be. And I also had to hide as best I could my discomfort, because I didn't want my mother to feel guilty or uncomfortable. And so that's one of the things that we can talk about a little bit later. But you've got to know your strengths and know your weaknesses. And if you're not comfortable doing this, don't do it. If you can supervise and help in some way, but you don't want your loved one to feel like they're a burden or mm-hmm. they feel guilty. And I wanted my mother to laugh. I said one of the things, one of my goals was to make her laugh at least once a day. And yes. She ended up making me laugh quite a bit. And I told her early on, I did this for several weeks, and then I had to go back to Los Angeles because I had a business there. Once I made the decision to come home, later in September, I came back for one of her grandson's weddings. And I took care of her again for the full 2 weeks that I was there. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I didn't have hospice. It was just me taking it on. And it was great because I grew up with three sisters, so I knew how to do a little bit more than put the toilet seat down. So they all had long hair. I knew how to take care of my mother's hair and got her all dolled up for the wedding. And this was her first outing since this near-death experience. And she had a grand time. And I called her in the book. I said she was the belle at the ball. And had a lovely time, and I saw the reaction not only of her with everybody around her, but it was infectious. Everybody mm-hmm. saw how well she was treated and how much fun she was having. They couldn't believe it. So I asked her during that time if she wanted me to come home and make sure that she was treated like this for the rest of her life, and she said yes. And so I said, first of all, if I do this, we're going to have fun. And she was a very funny lady. My dad was funny too, and luckily mm-hmm. they passed that on to us kids. And then I said, do you trust me? And that was a very important question, because she said yes, which was great. And I said, do you yes. understand that I will keep you healthy and happy for the rest of your life? And she said yes. And I said, well, that means I'm now in charge, and you must now obey me. Mm-hmm. And the mood completely changed. But she puckered up for a kiss. She loved kisses. And so I saw her puckered up lips, and I wasn't sure if that was a sign of surrender or one wishing me luck, because she could be a tough case. So I gave her a kiss and hoped for the best.
Yeah, yeah. And so that sort of leads me to my next question. And you may have already answered that just based upon what you shared in regards to relocating from LA to where your mother was. And the question was for you to describe a moment that you felt so deeply connected to your mother during this caregiving journey.
Well, I would have to say when I asked her if she trusted me, that was really important. I'm the youngest son and I'm the fifth out of the six kids. And I had a really good relationship with both of my parents. I was a very curious kid. I got them both to open up. They were from that generation that just kept everything close to the vest. They right. didn't talk about emotion. They didn't talk about pain. They didn't complain too much about things. And so there was some tension in the marriage as I was growing up. They had a long Catholic marriage and had some sparks in it. I was curious. I wanted to know what this was all about. And so I got them individually to open up about things. So the trust thing was good because that was years of me, I guess, probing mom for answers and trying to find out why she said on this particular day or why she did this. So that was a really important moment. And then I think just seeing her reactions to things, because it is physically, emotionally, and mentally, it's a tough job. But even during some of those hard days, I would see her smile or pucker up for a kiss or come back with a witty line. And I knew I was on the right track. And those were really important indicators that I was doing a good thing. And she was very accepting of it.
Because sometimes, let's be honest, parents can be a little bit stubborn, right? They could be, especially when the roles have changed. They can definitely be stubborn.
Well, yes, the parents and the kids. I mean, all of us, both of my parents worked full time. My mom was an only child, so she was very independent. And again, a tough cookie. Once I got to know mom better, I understood why there was some tension in the marriage. You know, dad was the louder one, so you thought he was the bad guy. But they were both equally guilty, I think, in that department. But they raised six very independent kids. And we all grew up in Jersey. So Jersey has a certain reputation anyway of being a bit brash and very opinionated. So it was interesting because all six of us had our own business at one point. And I wasn't sure if that was because we were ambitious or people were afraid to hire us.
Yeah. You know, you brought up something in regards to your parents having a sense of humor. And obviously through this episode of today, I can tell that you definitely have a sense of humor. And I heard you say your siblings did as well. Were there days that I know were tough and that ultimately one would have cried, but you had to use your sense of humor just to get you through that moment?
Yeah. Yeah. There was, I think, quite a few of those. Well, one of them was, this is several months into it. I'm not only doing all the cooking and shopping and sponge bathing and all this other stuff, I'm also wiping her butt several times a day. One morning, I came in to greet her, and I give her her morning juice, and she looks at me. She says, "Now, what is it I call you?" And I said, "You're kidding, right?" And she says, "No." I said, "Name your children." And she says, "Laurel, Michael, Carol, David, DC." And stumped. And I said, "Mark." She goes, "Oh, Mark. Mark with a K?" I said, "Yeah, you named me. I'm your favorite son." And she says, "I don't have favorites." And I said, "Well, you have a favorite to forget." And I could have taken that personally, but you know, she's a little older. She was suffering from a little bit of dementia. So I printed my name on big block letters and taped it to the ceiling as a visual aid. And so when I would come in the morning, I would say, "Good morning." And she'd say, "Good morning." And then her eyes would shoot up to the ceiling and say, and come back very proudly and say, "Mark." And after a few weeks, she remembered. But I have a chapter in the book asking the question, does wiping butt cause amnesia? And since I'm the one doing all that work and none of her kids were, and I was the only one she forgot, I have, I think, scientific evidence that, in fact, it does. It was quite a routine to get her ready for the day and also for bed at night. So she got sponge baths in the morning and in the evening. And at the end, so she's on the commode, I clean her up and then sponge bathe and then body lotion and things like that. And I'm just about to get the diaper closed and she starts peeing on me. And I said, "Well, that's cute if you're a new parent with a newborn." But not when it's your 90-year-old mother. So I'm like, Mom, why now? I just finished. And she says, it's natural. And I had to laugh. I was like, how can I be mad? Right. She had absolutely no control over any of her body functions at that point. And so it just, okay, we just start over again. So mm-hmm. she helped diffuse a lot of the frustration and stuff. But as far as, let's say, the cry, I'm tears are not hard for me, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to family. But I kept that away. I kept it out of the room as best mm-hmm. I could. So I don't think I ever cried in front of her. I don't think I cried during, it was a 3.5-year journey. And I wasn't, I don't want to ruin the ending of the book, but I didn't let it go because I had work to do even after Mom passed, until I think after the reception, after the funeral, where I was alone in the house and sitting in her room. I think the first time I let it go. And it was, I'm glad I was alone because it was Old Testament flooding. It was crazy. And there's other times, I mean, she was Irish. And so one time she was, again, a little sad this one day. So I started doing the river dance for her and made her laugh, but made my shins cry. So that might have been the first cry, you know. But these are the things you do, or at least, you know, I did for her. And one of the important things early on when I said she deserved better, she had these old day dresses and night dresses that were just kind of tattered. And she looked like an old lady, and her hair wasn't like, no one paid attention to her hair, or there was absolutely no makeup or lipstick or anything like that. She did have beautiful nails, and her nails still were polished, which was lovely. And that was one of the few things that made me smile when I first came back. But I wanted to return dignity to her that I felt was whittled away over the years with other people who weren't really paying attention. And so I bought her a new wardrobe. If you want to cheer a lady up, especially, but at any age, a new wardrobe will do that. So she loved it.
I will agree with you.
And I brought, you know, bright colors, and her legs were still in good shape for her age. So I bought them on the short side, and you know, she loved that. I don't know the last time she went to the beauty parlor, but when she used to visit me in LA, I took her to my friend Stan's in Beverly Hills, and she got the movie star treatment. And I knew she loved that. Mm-hmm. And she treated herself because she worked, again, full time and had 6 kids. She would go to the beauty salon once a week to get shampoo and set and get her nails done. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't know the last time that happened, but I wanted to do that for her. And I think that's just being the son. And maybe I took a little more of a romantic approach to it. But I created a thing I called Day of Beauty, where I tried to recreate that experience at home. So, you know, in between the sponge bath, you know, she's on the commode, I would soak her feet in Epsom salts. I would shampoo her hair. And then when she was finished on the commode, she picked out her new, or she got a full body massage with lotion. And then she picked out her new wardrobe. And then I blow dried her hair and put it in a ponytail, or for bonus points, braids. And she got a big kick out of it. And then I finished it off by doing her nails. And those things were like the crown jewels. I had to be very careful with those nails because she was a hand model back in her teens and early 20s. Wow. And those things were precious, but they were also lethal at that point, because as we get older, we get itchier, our skin gets thinner, and right. and she was scratching like crazy. So those lethal weapons had to be trimmed, and that took several days of beauty to get those down. A lot of charm went into convincing her that this had to be done. But the first day of beauty, so I finished with her nails, and I gave her some bright red lipstick to match her bright red nails, and I didn't think of anything. That it's just, this is a nice little gesture. But I put her in the wheelchair and wheeled her in to the kitchen for breakfast. And on the way in, we pass our big dining room mirror. Mm-hmm. And I parked her in front of that mirror and leaned in and said, who is that pretty girl? And she just beamed. And it was just, that was a very powerful moment, because that's when I learned that wanting to feel pretty doesn't fade with age.
Right.
And she was just, it was lovely, the effect on her. And every morning in between days of beauty, I would lean in and say, who is that pretty girl? I'd park her in front of that mirror. And It was infectious because she felt really loved and looked beautiful. And everybody around her just saw how happy she was. And that was a real important lesson, that little gestures can have a lot of power. That was lovely. So that was a big moment, I think, for the both of us. And so we did Day of Beauty every Saturday. I tried to do it on Sunday, but she was a good Catholic girl and said, no, we can't do that. So I moved it to Saturday. So every Saturday she got a Day of Beauty.
Wow. And I'm sure she was looking forward to that. You know, Mark, as you were talking, I don't know if you can see the smile on my face, and obviously someone's listening, they won't be able to see the smile on my face. But not only am I listening to you being a caregiver, right? And I know that you stated that you have other siblings. What I also hear and what I resonate with is a relationship that a mother and a son have, right? I know that you told me there were some trying times because mom had a different sense of humor, a different personality at times, may have not always been what one would consider to be nice, as you stated, but it also shows the connection, right? The initial connection that a mom and son have, because what it showed was the blood that flowed into you when you were inside of her, the care that she gave to you when you couldn't care for yourself, in turn, when she needed someone to care for her. You, along with your siblings, also did that, but it also shows again what a mother and son relationship really looks like. And so I have this smile as a mother myself, and knowing what that feels like and knowing what that is, you know, and I'm sure as other listeners are listening, I'm sure they can resonate with this as well. And so I just wanted to share that with you, because as you were speaking, my own heart was filled with joy. So I know if I feel the joy, I can only imagine the joy that your mother was feeling as you was dolling her up, as you stated.
Yeah, well, I have to blame, I think, both of my folks, because we were brought up in a very loving, nurturing home. And we learned how to, you know, people go, oh, you're a hero for doing this. And I don't look at it that way. I did what I felt was right. And we grew up, you know, Catholic. So honor thy father and mother. I mean, there's no better way to do that than do this stuff. And my siblings were great. They were very... I'm the guy who, let's say, jumped in, and I had the opportunity to do this, and this mm-hmm. is, and I was certainly willing to, and I'm not sure if someone else would have stepped in if I wasn't, but they were all very supportive, in their own way. So my younger sister had five kids of her own in the business in Michigan. And whenever she came, she was very hands-on. She would help out. My oldest brother, who's the one who hired people and looked after the family finances and took care of mom's meds and stuff before I came on board, he would come in on Tuesday nights and to keep in practice. So he would come in and cook dinner for us, and then he would get mom ready for bed. So if I needed some help at some point, he knew the routine. Mm-hmm. He didn't do it, let's say, as with the tender, loving care, let's say, I did, but it was good, and it was nice to have a family member. And then every few months, I had to go back out to L.A. to take care of the snack business. My sister also lived in California, would fly in and take my place. So we always had a family member there. And the two middle kids were not comfortable with the hands-on, and that was fine. They did other things to help out. And again, that would be some of my advice to people is, do what you're comfortable doing, or if you're not comfortable, hide it, because you don't want your loved one to feel, you know, guilty and feel like they're a burden in your life and stuff like that. So they were great. And they yielded like crazy. They would ask me if they could come over and visit. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is your house. Of course you can.
Right.
I don't know where maybe because I'm the tallest. I don't know. But it was like very interesting the dynamics that happened. You know, when I took it on, people kind of went, okay, now he's the boss. We have to, but they didn't have to go that far. So I was very lucky, because I've heard a lot of horror stories about sibling rivalry and all this other stuff and the battle, especially over finances and things mm-hmm. like that. And I was very fortunate. In that way.
All right. And what I heard you say, and I hope our listeners caught that as well, is that everyone knew what their strengths were, what they were capable of doing and what they weren't capable of doing. But everybody gelled together to put those pieces together for what mattered the most. Yeah. And so, Mark, as we are moving further into our episode today, I'm not going to overlook the fact that you just keep hinting about inserts of a book. And I know it's not just a book. So I want you to share with us about the book that you have referenced throughout this episode.
Well, the book is called A Cup of Tea on the Commode, My Multitasking Adventures of Caring for Mom and How I Survived to Tell the Tale. That, you know, when I was there, because I was a writer in Hollywood, you know, I wrote screenplays and things like that. And I've always recorded family history. And so during this, I'd say our 3.5 year journey, I was privy to a lot of really interesting moments and conversations that I didn't want my siblings to miss out on. So I started recording all this stuff. I did videos, I did photographs, but a lot of notes. And while I was doing this, I had a friend, being baby boomers, a lot of us are facing this, and she was going through it with her dad. And so I shared some of the things I was doing and some of the tips and tricks I learned from hospice, and she got some benefit out of it. And I said, well, you know, maybe I got something here that other people can benefit from. And I think a book is going to be the best way to do that. And so that's when I started focusing on a book. My, I guess, initial instincts would be, oh, I can make a movie out of this. And that's why I look at things cinematically and stuff like that. Right. So while I was doing this, it was not safe for mom to get in and out of the bathroom anymore. So we had to set a commode bedside. And sometimes Mother Nature took it a little longer than was comfortable for either one of us. So one day, kind of as a joke, I just said, Mom, would you like a cup of tea while you're waiting? That was her favorite beverage, a cup of tea, and skim milk, no sugar. And she said, sure. So I gave her a cup of tea and it became a hit. And so that was part of our morning ritual. So she got a cup of tea on the commode. And that title came out well into the writing. I had another title in mind. And I just thought that was really catchy. And it came out of it just a very practical thing. And another one of those moments that you didn't think that much of, but it was a very powerful moment because that was part of our ritual. Yes. And that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So Mark, when you were writing the book, was there ever a moment throughout that time that you just faced a difficult time just with the content of what you had to write about, knowing that it was part of your reality? As you stated, you were taking pictures, you were writing notes, and you wanted your siblings to be able to know, here's some things that was going on when you weren't able to physically be present.
Yeah, I needed some emotional distance for quite a bit because, again, I get very emotional when it comes to family, especially. And so mom passed in 2014, and I moved to France a couple years later. And whenever I would think of something that I thought could help with the book, I would jot down notes. So I had notes all over the place. But I had to wait, I think, a couple years before I could really sit down because a lot of it, even the ones that aren't emotional chapters, I would bawl. I wrote it in this room, and thank God I was alone for most of that time because it was embarrassing. And I mean, I'm not really embarrassed by it, but if somebody was there, I might feel a little differently. And so that emotional distance was very helpful. There's some very tough moments in there because people have said it's very raw. I wanted to write a very honest book and one that people could get something out of to kind of know what they're facing if they're going to do this. There's also a lot of laughs. It's very entertaining. So people say they cry out loud and they laugh out loud. So, I mean, that's like the best of both worlds. And they'll get some, hopefully, they'll learn something from it. So, but yeah, and of course, the last 5 days, it was like a 5-day vigil when mom really was leaving this earth. And I was up for most of that. And so recording that and then trying to write it, that was very tough. But again, I wanted that to be a very realistic and honest, told very, whether it's raw or not for other people, I don't know. But for me, certainly it was emotionally raw. But again, I tried to throw some laughs in there because we had, moments, and I call it dark humor. Sometimes at the worst moments in your life, you got to find something to laugh about or something just happens pop in because that's kind of my nature. So I would just say, a lot of it was tough. The real tough part was recording the audiobook. That's when all my acting skills had to come in. I couldn't do that for a number of months. After the book was released on Mother's Day, 2023, and there's no way I could have recorded the book. Again, even on chapters that weren't emotional, I would just hit a moment and just go, oh my, this is crazy. So 6 months later, and I was able to do some rewriting because I got a couple things from my siblings that they, I got my college, my sister's college major wrong, and my brother objected to some things. And so I took those things into consideration. So I had an opportunity to rewrite, at least for the audiobook. One of the most interesting things I think about that 6 month break is I got to revisit the book from a new lens, let's say, a new perspective. And if you look at the story, it looks like I went home to rescue my mom. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I did. But after thinking about this and again, looking at it with fresh eyes, I think my mom may have rescued me. Wow. Because at that point, you know, I had no children. I was never married. This gave me an opportunity to really learn what unconditional love was and learned that was a big lesson. And certainly empathy and patience and all those things parents have to go through. And so I wonder if mom had a hand in this somehow. But it's interesting. And I thought that was great because it was the most important thing I've done in my life. And as an actor, it was the best role I ever played.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you say also, I heard you say that it allowed you to have an understanding of unconditional love. Would you say also that this experience allowed you to have a greater understanding of aging and dignity as well?
Yeah, well, yes. It's easy for the dignity to disappear, I would have to say. So mm-hmm. it gave me an understanding. Now, whether that's going to happen for me, I don't know. I don't have kids. I did ask one of my nephews, I'm very close to, said, you're going to take care of Uncle Mark, aren't you? And he read this book and loved it. And so I didn't get a signed contract, but we'll see. I am concerned. I am concerned about it. But if nothing else, that gives you a motivation to keep living because I'm not sure who's taking care of me. I mean, I have a girlfriend here and she's lovely and stuff, but still, you don't know if we're both, you know, growing old together and we're not having kids. Maybe we'll just have some grandkids or something like, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But yeah.
So, Mark, as we are getting closer to the end of the episode, my hope and my goal is that many have been able to capture some of the things that you have shared with us, not just from the emotional side, but also from the practical side, if they should have to jump in and or if they're currently taking care of their parents. But if someone were to read your book, what message would you want them to receive from this book in regards to just themselves, their patient level or their ability to care for someone who can't care for themselves?
I tell people I've had a very adventurous life. I'm living in France. I don't speak the language. When I first came in, this was all kind of crazy why I'm here. But we have French ancestors on my mom's side, so maybe they had something to do with this. But it's lovely, and it's they have a lovely way of life here. But in any adventure that I've gone into, I've always looked for the joy in it. That's my mindset. And if you look for the joy in it, because there's so much negativity in the world and taking on a challenge, it can be stressful in many ways. But if you say, I'm going to find the joy in this, it makes it so much easier mm-hmm. if you focus on the positive parts of any adventure. Because I started a bunch of companies. I say I started 5 nonprofit companies, though none were intended to be nonprofit. I learned from it, each one of those experiences and took it to the next. And it was interesting. So I just I did an event at it was a building and had Nelson Mandela's name on it. And a friend of mine is good friends, was good friends with Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And he had a lovely quote that I saw the other day. He says, I don't fail. I learn. Mm-hmm. And powerful. I thought that it's lovely. And that's kind of what I've done. And so if you go in with that, let's say that mindset, at least for me, it works, and an open heart and say, okay, this person is someone I love. I want to put the focus on them and not on me. And if you set a goal like I did to make her laugh once a day or whatever it is you need to do to get through it, because again, it's a tough job. Mm-hmm. I would have to advise other people too, is you got to take the breaks. You have to learn from the pros. And that's something I didn't listen. When my sister and I were taking care of my mom when hospice was still there, we took breaks because we had a hospice nurse that would stay with mom. And so we went out mm-hmm. for walks and things like that. When I took it over, I rarely did that. I said, I'm mm-hmm. a guy, I can handle this. And it caused some physical problems for me. So listen, learn what you can from the pros and listen to them. Take the breaks because there's a reason why on the airline they say put your oxygen mask on before you tend to your loved ones, because you've got to be in good shape mentally, physically, emotionally, if that's all possible, to effectively take care of your loved one. And so that would be the thing. And I'm thinking, you know, the book is not a how-to book. It's mm-hmm. a what I did book. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some good people have said, and caregiver experience or experts have said they think there's a lot of good stuff in there. But I'm hoping to inspire other people to do this. It's going to be a health crisis, and it's certainly a financial crisis in the future if it's not already. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the old days, we had all three generations in the home, and we respected our elders, and we learned from them, and that's been lost. And I'm surprised, even in France, I thought, oh, this would be different over here. No, assisted living and nursing homes is where they put them. They don't want that responsibility. And again, if you're not comfortable doing it, that might be the way to do it, because you don't want to have, you know, all that tension in the house and anybody feeling like they're a burden is not good for anybody. So I think through this story, there's a lot of fun in there and some tips. And I'm just hoping to inspire, if nothing else, the guys, because most of the caregiving still falls on the women of the family. But we're catching up. It's about a 60-40 split now, I think. I've heard from a lot of guys who have read the book that they love it, and they've learned something from it. And I even had a friend in Tennessee. His mother says she wants to adopt me. Well, that's a possibility.
So you may be heading back to Tennessee, huh?
Whatever. You know, if that's a way to get there. I mean, the book is done very well. I mean, it's won a bunch of literary awards, which is very nice. But the personal notes that I've received from people have just been incredible. So it is resonating. And that was something I didn't know what to expect with that, because mm-hmm. you put your heart and soul into something, you don't know if it's going to touch people. Right. And this luckily is touching people, has touched, and it continues to. And that's very rewarding, because I know that's making my mom smile.
Yeah. You know, Mark, as you were speaking, I think I shared with you before that I've written a memoir, should I say. And when I was writing, it was very tough at times to write, right? But it was also a healing moment for me. As you were speaking, something you said really, really resonated with me, because when I wrote the book, I really wrote it for myself, right? I wrote it through my own lens, what I had been through, where I was trying to go with life. But then after I wrote the book and I sat back and I thought about this, I said, wait a minute, I didn't really write this book for myself. I wrote this book to give other people aspirations and inspiration when they're going through different things, that no matter what you may go through, that there's always a silver lining through something. And there's always positivity, even when it seems like everything around you is negative, right? And so yep. I was truly able to capture what you just said in reference to, yes, this story is about me, but yet so many people have read and have been inspired by your words and your story. So I think that's impactful within itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very nice. I mean, it's rewarding, certainly.
So, Mark, as we are at the end of Heart to Heart with Keisha B., could you please share with the listeners where they can find your book?
Well, if they Google A Cup of Tea and a Commode, we're everywhere. I mean, it's on Amazon. There's four formats, and Amazon has all of them. So it's a paperback, large print paperback, ebook, and also the audiobook. Barnes & Noble has, they have at least a large print. I don't know why they don't have the others. A lot of other stores like Kobo Online and things like that. There's some brick and mortar stores around the States that have it. And I think around the world, our distributor has this in languages, I don't know, not translated in the language, but in stores all over the world that I look and try to figure out where they are. I have no idea. But mm-hmm. so they do a good job with that. And then we have a YouTube channel with a lot of these funny teasers. There's probably 180 of those so far. That I'm pretty aggressive with marketing, and a lot of my Hollywood stuff comes in there. So I do a lot of these little teaser videos. Everywhere from TikTok to Pinterest, the Facebook page. There's my personal page, Mark Poro, but also the Cup of Tea on the Commode. And then the A Cup of Tea on the Commode channel on YouTube is there. And that's we're everywhere. So there's going to be a sale around Mother's Day. And okay. And also people have said, mothers have said, I'm buying this for my kids because I want them to learn how to take care of me when I need it. And I thought, well, that's a lovely gesture. So, yeah.
I love it. So for all of our listeners out there, Mark has shared with you where you can find his book. Again, it's in print. And it's also for those who really don't have the time to sit down and read. You can also listen to it while you're driving, while you're washing dishes, whatever it may be, or while you're taking care of your loved one. So as always, we want to thank you for listening today and supporting Heart to Heart with Keisha B. Again, if you are a new listener, thank you so much for your support. Continue to follow us. If you are returning listeners, always, I want to thank you so much. Follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, as well as iHeartRadio. Have a great evening. Thank you for tuning in to Heart with Keisha B. Remember, grief may shape our journey, but it doesn't define who we are. Healing is not a straight path, but with every step forward, you're creating space for hope, strength, and new beginnings. If today's episode brought you comfort or clarity, share it with someone who might need it too. Let's continue building this community of compassion and resilience together. Until next time, take care of your heart, your mind, and your soul. Honor your journey and always know that brighter days are ahead. I am Keisha B., and this has been Heart to Heart.